So return to, I guess, what may well be the final in a series, the rare time I finish an ongoing series. Although, looking back at my original Civilized Worlds video, which I put together five years ago, it dawned on me that perhaps five sentences may well have been too brief to describe some Imperial worlds, but these were different times. So until I somehow revise these past discrepancies, we'll continue looking at the planet types, conditions, and installations of the Imperium of Man. Except we won't, because this video is all about Xenos planets. The Imperium of Man is said to maintain anything in the estimated region of 1 million worlds, and one of its ongoing goals is to locate, liberate, and unite any potential outstanding lost human colonies. Although admittedly, some of these worlds are discovered lost and then rediscovered once again, as is the fractured, chaotic nature of the human galactic empire. The Imperium has its so-called civilized worlds, where primarily its ordinary citizens live their lives. Some may enjoy a tolerable, even pleasant quality of life, a privilege few known as the nobility govern and exploit the extremely minimal luxuries, while the members of noble families and guilds forge lives for themselves as wealthy traders ever jostling for positions of power. Many of these worlds are known as hive worlds that represent production centres for humanity. Industry and manufacturing concerns, neither of which are particularly appealing to most, as lives for the masses here mean grinding physical labour or lives in hazardous environments. Servitude in extremely poor conditions or under the threat of bizarrity by twisted human minds in the nobility or those with power. The exceptional production centres known as Forge Worlds are managed by the Mechanicus, and they are therefore entirely different in their management compared to those worlds governed by humanity and accountable to the Imperial Administratum, whereas Forge Worlds answer only to Mars. For all of its achievements, though, humanity has not managed to eradicate nor cease the continual disruption caused by what humans in the 41st millennium refer to collectively as the Xenos. This umbrella term refers to all alien life that is not human and includes those known to us as the Eldar or Eldari and their twisted cousins, the Drakari, the Tau Empire, Orcs, the Necrontyr or Necron, and of course the Tyranids. The Crone Worlds are some of the most ancient and likely cursed planets in the galaxy of M41, for they're known as some of the very first worlds believed to have been colonised by that most ancient race known as the Eldar or Eldari. However, this is where I will now place a second subtitle. For the Eldar, Crone Worlds are a truly bizarre planet. They're also known to be designated as Demon Worlds. The Eldar race are so old, by any standards of the Imperium, that now much of their ancient history is lost even to themselves, especially since the time known as the Fall, when the Chaos God Slaanesh came into being. Their history is not told, though, through carefully time-stamped administrative documents like that of the Imperium. Instead, though, it is told through poems, fables, and stories passed down by word of mouth throughout Eldar history. Like the Necron, the Eldar are one of the few species in the galaxy to have existed as close to the beginning of the galaxy as is possible, and only the mysterious Old Ones came before them. It's almost unknowable at this time as to whether their tales of gods are metaphorical or represent actual figures in this time, and even if the stories are real, were the Eldar gods real in the truest sense? Were they real entities or something else entirely? Did they represent perhaps just powerful technology that is now both lost and impossible to recreate? The Eldar mythology is one of the more difficult pieces of lore to wrap your head around. This is mainly because of how vague and symbolic much of the descriptions surrounding them seem to be. The time known as the War in Heaven speaks of powers and battles beyond the comprehension of mortal beings in M41, so trying to accurately discern just what it all means through the stories of the Eldar is almost an impossibility. But if you did want to learn more in detail about the Eldar origins and mythology, I would recommend looking at my Dark Origins Part 2, which covers this, and I've linked at the end of this video. As noted, the mythological descriptions of Eldar gods describe the creation and origin of what are known as Eldar Spirit Stones. These are also called the Tears of Isha. Now, these stones are critical to the protection of Eldar souls. In the ancient times, the Eldar soul would return to the calmness of the warp space before eventually returning in the birth of a new Eldar. This cycle of reincarnation was then disrupted with the birth of Slaanesh, who now will harvest and capture any Eldar soul which would return to the warp. The Eldar Spirit Stones prevent this, and they're placed all over an Eldar's armour. When they die, these stones will capture their soul, and the stone is then placed into an Eldar craft world, so-called Infinity Circuit, where it merges with other Eldar souls. Spirit stones of long-dead Eldar are also utilised by being placed into Wraithguard and Wraithlord constructs. These are then effectively piloted by the Eldar soul, or in some cases of the larger constructs, multiple souls. They can also be placed into other vehicles to act as what the Imperium would see as essentially a machine spirit, to basically help guide, pilot, and aid in the general functionality of the vehicle. The strange ability of the Eldar to use their souls in this manner actually points to something I have vaguely discussed previously in why Eldar souls are different to that of humans, in that human souls seemingly dissipate back into the warp and then of course feed the powers there, whereas the Eldar souls seem to be somehow more resilient. If we are to believe the great fear of the Eldar that their souls are all held by Slaanesh and remain there tortured for all time. So spirit stones are essential for the Eldar, and critically the only place they're believed to be able to be found are in the most ancient of worlds, presumably where once their gods walked and forged the origins of their entire way of life, before, during, and in the aftermath of the war in heaven. Unfortunately for the Eldar, the only place these stones are to be found, of course, is the Crone Worlds, named as such for their god, Morai Heg, who was said to have gifted the Eldar their abilities of foresight. Being the oldest of Eldar worlds, they were located in and around where it's believed the Eldar must have originated, and many home planets of the Eldar were of course entirely destroyed or scoured from existence during the massive destructive event which saw the gigantic tear in reality known as the Eye of Terror become manifest, as the fall of the Eldar heralded the birth of Slaanesh. Of course, the power of chaos infuses any worlds trapped within or bridging the warp, and its presence there begins to allow the impossibilities of the warp to become reality. Goliath forms stalk the bizarre landscapes, demons pouring out from the living earth, huge rusting mechanical monstrosities who defy the very concept of a living being. Trapped mortals on such worlds must endure this life of horror, this purgatory, much like the poor tortured souls witnessed by Uriel Ventress when he discovered the horrors of the Demonculaba upon Medrilingard. So it is told how the planet known to the Eldar as the World of Immortal Sorrows, once at the very heart of the Eldari civilization, also now exists as a crone world where demons boil Eldari souls in rivers of tears, likely referencing their god Isha. Upon countless other demon worlds, armies of these warp entities fight amongst themselves as pawns of the gods in their great game, whilst nearer to real space, Imperial strike forces fight desperate crusades against what are unknown to them, in essence, their own dark reflections. So demonic worlds are a disturbing reminder to the rest of humanity just what awaits them should the Imperium fall to chaos. When people speak about the ongoing conflicts within the 41st millennium, a very common one is when people say something along the lines of chaos would never truly destroy humanity because then chaos itself would eventually cease to exist. Now there's always a possibility that that could be true, but generally speaking, it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the objectives of chaos overall, and just how the galaxy would look, how it would be reshaped were the Imperium to collapse and humanity be left relatively defenseless. I feel this is something I want to look at in an adjacent video more, but the short version is the answer to this suggestion is no, chaos wouldn't just become invalidated immediately by the collapse of the Imperium. Instead, what you would see is a galaxy which would become essentially farmed for the pleasure of the Chaos Gods, with humanity being its cattle. So not unlike the harrowing descriptions from Dead Sky Black Sun, you would also see such horrors like that throughout the planets of humanity all across the galaxy. The key thing though is to remember that within the Chaos Gods great game, it is more truly believed that if one Chaos God were able to defeat the others, yes, then perhaps there could be a long-term situation where chaos kind of became invalid, and that it is this great game between all of the gods which helps pull, wax, wane, and keep things within them in balance so that they don't end up basically obliterating themselves in the process. So how do we know this? Well, because not only do demon worlds actively illustrate this to us in a more microcosm way, but also because worlds invaded by chaos do the same. Many planets afflicted by the traits of the chaos gods see their populations not obliterated and scoured from the world. Human populations serve chaos in two equally important ways. Mortals both provide the manpower for the armies of chaos, especially for the armies that invade the material universe, and they also worship, thereby contributing to their presence in the warp, although the distorted version of worship. It's only those who are clear-minded or perhaps mentally broken enough to fight their way free of the nightmarish holding pits, worship congregations and dark manufactori who have any hope to actually fight in the name of chaos. And fight might be something of a generous statement. Most humans serving chaos in battle will be slaughtered mercilessly. The majority of humans upon demon worlds serve through both labour and worship. Unfortunately for the damned souls, their salvation is all but impossible, and their strange environment may even lead to them turning unknowingly toward chaos in the initial stages. Each day their pain becomes less, their rapture becomes more, until eventually the most savage beatings will become a thing to be even desired. Like many who serve chaos, most notably those who follow Slaanesh, mortals on demon worlds can become frenzied with pleasure as they approach terminal extremes of self-sacrifice. For any ordinary humans observing this is perhaps one of the most truly foul and offensive sights to witness. For humans left to become totally disconnected from reality upon demon worlds, they would eventually become so twisted as they attempt to gain favour by committing ever more extreme acts so as to please their overlords. These cacophonous waves of suffering and pleasure are of course exactly what the demonic pits and industries are designed for. Scrabbling, tearing, ripping, choking, vomiting, skinless, blood-pouring nightmare things that barely appear human apart from flailing appendages, orifices, and piercing screams that become so extreme they break apart eventually. Demonic worlds are an ocean of mortal suffering. Planetary scale foundries of worship for the ever-thirsting gods. Anonymous millions whipped into a mindless scale of suffering so much that eventually the warp may acknowledge their frenzied prayers and a world's demonic prince get a mote of recognition, while the ruinous powers grow ever more powerful through their sacrifice. And through this, we see how a galaxy dominated by chaos would not see necessarily the instant extinction of humanity. It would see its eternal subjugation at the altar of the dark gods. A galaxy of worlds would be their millstone and the grain thrown into it, the mortal souls of humanity. Now, of course, another simple remedy quickly held up is the Imperium's most powerful tool of Exterminatus. It seems a simple solution, does it not? Merely scour a world, prevent the darkness of chaos from enveloping it. Unfortunately, as the Inquisition have commonly discovered, Exterminatus of demonic worlds is usually not a readily achievable option. For reasons not fully understood, once a world has become twisted and enveloped by the warp, it appears to occupy some bizarre bridging point between the realm of the Materium and Immaterium. And consequently, most demon worlds cannot effectively be cleansed with Exterminatus. This is, of course, one of the reasons as to why the Imperium so voraciously pursues any indication of chaotic incursion upon an Imperial world, both externally and internally. So while the actions of the Inquisition may often seem very extreme, there is some truth to the Inquisitional quotation that states, "Some may question my right to destroy a world of 10 billion souls, but those who truly understand realize that I have no right to let them live. No sacrifice is too great, and no treachery too small." This is of course not to mention the fact that upon demon worlds, extermination of humans is not necessarily even the objective. The suffering, the endless conflict, the power for the great game is what chaos wants more than anything. And this is why upon demon worlds, you'll often see conflicts occurring with bizarre armies of demons, humans, and potentially even traitor marines that will last for centuries. A continual waxing and waning of power and territory, not dissimilarly to the larger game the Chaos Gods play among themselves. So while some of the most well-known demon worlds to the Imperium are devoted to a single Chaos God or ruled by some notably powerful demon prince, many more are white-hot cauldrons of unending war, where no individual or specific faction dominates. For any humans who have somehow managed to find a corner of the world to carve out and survive within as their own, have very likely forgotten, as I said, the Imperium and the Emperor existed long ago, and now battle for themselves and their survival or whatever strange culture they have created here. Again, this is historically demonstrated to us both during the Great Crusade and worlds that were twisted by what we well presume to be the Dark Gods. And even during the time of unification, the Emperor had to purge bizarre cults of witchcraft that had sprung up upon Terra itself. And these were likely chaos worshipping, even though they didn't know it, the Emperor certainly didn't let anybody else know that. Many demon worlds are not even as demonic as their namesake suggests. In fact, demons, just as with anywhere within the mortal realm, find it very difficult to exist here. And so when we might observe many worlds who straddle both reality and the warp, demons may not actually be particularly common, and those who are seen may be in service to an especially powerful follower of a chaos god, or maybe it's a world which simply leans more toward the realm of the warp than real space. The most common demon world would be a planet twisted and racked by the powers and strange non-physics of the warp, whereby they very obviously become largely disconnected from the Imperium and the rest of humanity, and instead they exist as a terrifying foreshadowing for what awaits the rest of humanity should Chaos march its armies of darkness across the galaxy unrestrained. An existence of eternal suffering, planetary scale battlegrounds, where any human inhabitants who survive here will fuel the unending demonic crossfire. For Inquisitors who hail from the more tolerant side of Inquisitional ideology, some might call them radical even, they may see the benefits in securing any who have escaped from such hellscapes as demon worlds. Humans who have experienced such twisted realms and retained some semblance of their sanity are indeed rare, and those who might escape, even rarer. Most often, they'll be so broken by their experiences, at the minimum unable to discern reality for themselves, that they will end up becoming so-called penitents. But inquisitorial retinue penitents are not necessarily the same as penitent engines used by the sororitas. While technically, yes, both heretics, it's likely that penitents encased in the sarcophagi of a penitent engine will have committed, most likely very willingly, some horrific heretical crime. Whereas individuals captured escaping demon worlds would be considered heretics still for being exposed to such dark and corrupting forces, but this was most likely against their will. Still, no excuse, but it's unlikely they'll have any true sense of what direction they even should be heading for in the first place, the fact that they managed to escape a miracle. Either way, an inquisitor who has somehow acquired such an individual will subject them to extended periods of purification, interrogation, and cleansing. They will also be allowed under the extreme methods used by inquisitors to confess their crimes, should they even have any concept of such a thing, and provide other information to inquisitors that may be helpful. What do they know of a world? Were there any notable figures there? What were the powers on that world? Do they have any knowledge of what was taking place in a sense of a wider goal, and so on? All of this is very high value information for an inquisitor who may need to make urgent communications to reinforce Imperial territory should a chaos incursion be on the brink of taking place. Most of these captured individuals will of course die in the process, or they're considered too broken and otherwise irredeemable to be allowed to live, and so are simply destroyed. For a select few of the strongest who survive both the nightmare of the demon world and the subsequent soul scouring by an inquisitor, they may be given a rare opportunity to save themselves and their eternal soul by serving the Inquisition in some capacity, and therefore of course the Emperor of Man. So should a penitent be granted a second life in fanatical service to the inquisitor that redeemed them, this may take several forms. Most commonly, it will be, unfortunately most likely, in service to their inquisitor. They will be bound with wards and anointed sacred oils to ensure they do not unwittingly become consumed by their powers or used as some means to breach between real space and the warp. Their role is unfortunately far less glorious than it may sound, of course, for penitents act essentially as psychic lightning rods. They shadow an inquisitor or their retinue members, and should they be assaulted by a rogue psyker or demonic entity, the penitent functions by attracting and dissipating psychic attacks. Unfortunately, of course, for the penitent, this may well lead them to themselves being burned out through the psychic fires channeling through them, but in doing so, they will save a true servant of the Emperor, and this may be the only laudable act they ever accomplish. in the rarest of situations, an escaped individual of a demon world may be, by some miracle, redeemed by an Inquisitor. The circumstances needed to align to enable this to occur are, of course, extremely unlikely, but if it does, they can prove to be extremely useful, as they will have had an opportunity to experience beings and sights the likes of which no human can begin to even imagine. Their largest benefit to an Inquisitor is in granting their wealth of forbidden knowledge and experiences that are otherwise, for an Inquisitor, largely unobtainable. There are few, if any, situations where they might acquire such details without severe risk of corruption or just plain annihilation. And for so-called radical Inquisitors, they fully see the benefit in turning the corruption and power of chaos upon itself. And such penitent individuals may be useful in revealing heretics or planning how to best exterminate them from a world. That, or they may simply be extremely adept at fighting horrors that would make most humans of the Imperium vomit in terror. And so, having someone beside you who is able to face down the darkness, as it were, is always advantageous for a member of an inquisitorial retinue. Now lastly, whilst we're talking about crone worlds and demon worlds, let's circle back around to the Eldar. For the most important of demon worlds remain those crone worlds, and while their use in acquiring spirit stones remained important, they have played a far more important role for the newly emergent faction within the Eldar known as the Inari. These ancient demon crone worlds held the tools that may well unlock a whole new era for the Eldar if successful. For it is the Inari's goal that they will be the ones who will finally save all souls of the Eldar, and more importantly, see the restoration of their race to glory and immortality. That is, their ability to safely reincarnate once again without the threat of Slaanesh devouring their souls. Interestingly, this faction's ultimate goal is appealing to both the Craftworld Eldari and the so-called Dark Eldar, the Drakkari. And for this reason, we see the two bizarrely come together to work for a common goal when pledging their service to the Inari. They've also attracted members like from the Exodites and the Harlequins. And this is highly unusual, but also the quasi-religious cult-like nature of the Inari has seemed to break down the barriers that usually separate the factional ideological differences of the Eldar when their goal is the eternal salvation of all. The Inari are attempting to bring a so far unseen Eldar god known as Inead into existence. To achieve this, they're looking for five so-called crone swords. Their legends tell that the god Morai Heg gave up her hand to another god known as Cain, who is commonly seen as the avatar of the Eldar in battle, and in giving up her hand, it was so that she might drink her own blood and then know her fate, as only one god could harm another. And it would be from the finger bones of this hand of the crone that Vol, the god of smiths, would craft the crone swords. Together, these blades had the power to awaken a god. If wielded in the right hands, they had dominion over life as well as death. Two of these blades, though, were lost amongst the ruins of the crone worlds. If all were to be acquired, drawn, and bonded together, the god known as Inead should have a strong enough focus in real space to awaken fully and manifest its potential as the destructor of Slaanesh. In the end times of M41, the leader of the Inari and emissary of Inead is known as Ivrain. But as so far, she has only secured four of these five crone swords, one of which is wielded by Ivrain herself. This is known as the Sword of Sorrows, said to cause its victims instant death by turning them to ash. Another is wielded by her visage, the Sword of Silent Screams, which will absorb a being's life essence. A third is held by the avatar of Inead itself, Inkarne, and this sword so powerful it was able to easily bisect a greater demon of Slaanesh. It is known as the Sword of Souls and was recovered from one of the demon planet crone worlds. Lastly, we have Prince Uriel, who wields the Spear of Twilight, which whilst a spear is still considered to be one of the crone swords and is said to contain the energies of a dying sun. This is no normal weapon and remains eternally bound to Uriel as it slowly is consuming his soul. He in fact uses a personal force field to help mitigate the worst of its effects. It's such a powerful weapon. The evident power of Inead, though, was demonstrated when Ivrain managed to call the avatar of Inead, the Inkarne, and this allowed many of the Eldar to see plainly demonstrated that the beliefs of the Inari were not some crazed visions of a dying cult, but a very real and tangible goal. And this is what's led to the followers of Ennead continuing to grow in numbers at the end of M41, and they have gained strength by absorbing any who might follow and pledge themselves to the Inari cause, no matter their former background. But just how the differences between all those groups and the various ways they've learned to live and fight, like say the Corsairs, Harlequins, Exodites, and then still evade Slaanesh, are still to be resolved. What kind of fractured groups and problems it could create are unknown. Another thing is that it's difficult to determine just what the future holds for the Inari. While they have had so far some debatable initial success, it's unlikely that things will continue to be smooth sailing. It's very difficult also to know if the Inari have achieved real positive gains in the grand scheme of things, or simply furthered the already very fractured Eldari more than they already were. But for many, their greatest achievement was to unite by shining a visible ray of hope for what appeared to be an otherwise doomed civilization. Still, the final Crone Sword is yet to be recovered. And when searching the Demon World and Crone World of Belial IV, Yvraine secured the sword held by the Avatar of Ennead. But there were believed to be two here on the world, and the last is said to have been seen in a vision by Yvraine as having been transported inside a palace of Slaanesh itself, making any attempts to secure it at this point essentially unachievable, as well as suicidal for any attempts. There are other indications that the Inari do not fully believe this and are still actively searching for the blade, suggesting that all hope is in fact not yet lost for their cause, or that even if the sword is in a palace of Slaanesh, they may find some means to still access it. I should finally note that this is one of the more actively developing narratives in the lore, and as such the final resolution, or how it may be framed, shifted and interpreted in the coming years or years, remains somewhat unknown. I think more on that later from me, because it feels something very worthy of discussion. Thankfully though for the Eldar, the Fall did not entirely extinguish all of their achievements from the galaxy. In fact, while primarily the Eldar themselves have tended to remain aboard their vast space vessels known as Craftworld, they also still retain planets they consider to hold ownership over. These will often connect with the Eldar Webway. The so-called Maiden Worlds are awe-inspiring paradise worlds created before the Fall. During the End Times, those among the Eldar who had not chosen a path of self-annihilation through depravity were making plans to seek out alternative solutions to escape the nightmare of what was fast becoming the death spiral of Eldari culture. It had become progressively clearer to many that the stark differences between factions within their society had become so extreme that those who were now opposed to a traditionally self-disciplined, restrained way of life had fully removed any remaining guardrails and were now becoming lost souls, unable to be convinced of or even hear any reasonable path back to more bland but logical ways of thinking. They had in essence become a completely unrecognizable branch of the Eldar civilization, so completely immersed in their decadent self-serving pleasure cults that the situation had now long passed the point of ever being resolvable. This, of course, would lead to the literal separation of Eldar culture and the emergence of those known now as the Jakari. Yet even amid the very visible signs of collapse that were everywhere to be seen, few of the more traditional Eldar leaders were apparently able to foresee the complete and total implosion of their society that was still to come. Either that, or they simply chose to do nothing out of an impotent sense of willpower or a sense of guilt and despair at the sheer horror of what those who had chosen a path of self-indulgent delusion were now openly displaying to all. The end was in sight, but by the time it was clear that it was action not words that had become necessary, the slide into a full-blown catastrophic collapse was no longer preventable. Eldar society, as it had once been, a shining beacon of culture and arts, mastery of their specific blend of warp technology, would be destroyed in the massive psychic shockwave which tore through the barrier between warp and real space and gave rise to the new god of chaos, Slaanesh, and transform an area of the galaxy into what would become known forevermore as the Eye of Terror, the vast Maw gateway between the formless wastes of chaos and the mortal realm of the Materium. Despite billions of Eldar being vaporized instantly at the point in time of this event, a decent number of Eldar had survived on the craft worlds, which had been under construction for some time in response to the steady slide that would become the destruction of the majority of their race. And those who saw the writing on the wall were looking for solutions to get out. For those who did not simply opt for a life effectively sailing through the oceans of space, there was conveniently another option, the Maiden Worlds. These were planets that the Eldar had looked at as being potentially feasible for future colonization. The advanced technological skills of the Eldar are to be in no doubt, for they seemingly unlocked the skills required from somewhere, we might speculate the Old Ones, the ability of creation via seeding barren planets with life, leading to their transformation as rich life-supporting worlds. Simple bacteria would be introduced to create a stable atmosphere first, and then gradually more complex organisms were added to stabilize the early environment and ecosystem of the planet. Luckily for those looking to escape the terrifying horror of the fall, this process had been underway for some time through the use of Eldari ships known as Dominion Genesis, and this colonizing plan had been part of a wider, more concerted effort toward the end of their civilization in terms of expansion to eventually spread out more across the galaxy, and it appears that despite the Eldar living lives far beyond that of most mortal humans, their vast culture had in fact been fairly limited in spread comparative to humans despite the vast timescale, and likely due to their less than prolific reproduction comparative to humanity. Still, they had made plans to expand beyond the region of the galaxy from where they originated, and in the distant future these life-seeded worlds would be ready for colonization by the Eldar. Once the process had begun, it was fairly self-sustaining, but for it to happen in a stable and permanent manner, the process required thousands of years to complete. For the Eldar pre-fall, this was of no concern. Their lifespans made such periods of time appear like mere months or years by humans' comprehension of the scale of time. As the end times for the Eldar became ever more apparent, a renewed interest in these worlds, whatever their state of development, took hold. And while some Eldar planned to escape the horror aboard craft worlds, other sections of their society looked upon these maiden planets as their new home. Those who sought refuge upon the Maiden Worlds made a huge exodus from their former homeworlds and would make vast migration fleets to travel to the newly developing planets. This exodus earned them the new title of Exodite Eldari. The Exodites had to settle the still commonly barren Maiden Worlds, and it wouldn't be until the Age of the Imperium that these planets would become lush, verdant paradise worlds. So perhaps inevitably, many were settled by non-Eldar races like orcs and humans. Now very obviously these non-Eldari colonists are considered invaders by the Eldar, as not all Maiden Worlds were colonized immediately surrounding the fall. So it may be millennia before the Eldar in fact would arrive to find their worlds having already become inhabited by other races, and for good reason. Maiden worlds are often highly rich in resources, as well as having been specifically tailored by the Eldari planet seeders to be safe from illnesses and resistant to harmful lifeforms, the like of which you might generally see on jungle death worlds and so on. So with that in mind, those who have inhabited a maiden world are unlikely to want to easily leave. They have no concept of the Eldar ownership of such places, and often this leads to conflict, with the Eldar seeking to purge the invaders by any means necessary. More disturbing and rage-inducing for the Eldar are those times when they arrive to a maiden planet, but far too late, and the damage of invasive others is already done. One such example would be that of Meridian. This world, like so many maiden planets, used to be rich in its resources and beauty, with lush green forests, rolling green plateaus, mountains dense with minerals. Exactly the kind of planet that when the Imperium arrived, it deemed to be ripe for harvesting. Meridian is now a heavily polluted, scarred world, punctuated by hive cities that dot the landscape and pierce the skies. Previously crystal clear rivers are now choking toxic streams of industrial and waste effluent so strong that it will strip your skin. Green endless meadows replaced by dank swamps full of exiled quasi-human horrors and untold numbers of other mutated creatures. Likely once beautiful and rich in colours, now it is a barren and drab wasteland. Little is spared when a planet is turned to industrial colonization by humanity, be it dramatic mountain ranges or dense, zen-like whispers between the trees of great forests. now ash and dead and home to strange tales of wisp-like ghosts and worse. The human explorators who designated Meridian a planet for industrialization did so primarily because of the discovery of a source here of energy, an isotope called helium-3. This is undoubtedly something deliberately designed by the Eldari because in specific conditions it was discovered by the explorators that helium-3 can continue to produce power and heat for what projections have suggested could be eternity, or for all intents and purposes anyway. Unfortunately for the Eldar, the Imperium very obviously recognized the worth in this resource, and that is why massive defense networks now crisscross the mountain ranges of Meridian, and why in Hive Arcadia there has been constructed a colossal ground-to-orbit defense laser that can target any space vessels in orbit or even the close region of Meridian. Another Hive city contains large sensor arrays and spaceports fitted with Death Strike missile launchers. The Eldar and total ecological collapse are not necessarily, though, the greatest concern for the invasive humans now settled on Meridian, for a massive asteroid, some might wish to call it a rock, is barreling towards Meridian. It has very unfortunately both orcs and worshippers of chaos upon it, and they are already fighting. It's being further powered with massive engines towards Meridian. So not something that any Imperial world would look forward to. Such a vast strike upon the world would be undoubtedly a bad thing, and the Imperium are well aware of this. However, the Eldar also arrived through a secret webway gate commonly placed on many maiden worlds, and so Meridian is now another world where massive conflict seems to be about to rage. Its ultimate fate hangs by a thread, not entirely dissimilarly to many worlds within the current Octarius sector. So while some maiden worlds face near endless conflict, or have already been scarred horribly by dim-witted humanoids in the eyes of the Eldari, other planets were successfully colonized by Exodites. Exodite lifestyle, though, is very divergent to that of both Craftworld Eldar and the Drakari. For the Exodites, in their separation from the previous order of things, took this time to reflect on what had brought them to this point. And somewhat comparably to the feudal and night worlds of the Imperium, the Exodites chose a different path. So Exodite Eldar live a more primitive and basic style of living than the other surviving Eldar. They learned to live by growing crops, hunting, surviving from what the land gave to them, not relying on technology, and critically not relying on the warp. The entirety of Eldar culture to this point in time had relied upon using the Immaterium, and this was seen very obviously as now a dangerous thing. So the Exodites divided into clans, each led with a warrior elite, and in the modern age of the galaxy, Exodite worlds exist in a seemingly pre-industrial state. While some Eldar look down to the Exodites as simplistic and stagnant, others see them as potentially a new way for the Eldar to live, and so will aid them and generally maintain good relationships. Outcasts also may find a refuge among the Exodites, who are generally less judgmental, so long as those who join them are capable of adapting to their ways. Many Exodites also do not live in permanent settlements like towns and cities, but exist in a more semi-permanent nomadic way of life. Maiden worlds are lush and beautiful, and so travelling around is both something to enjoy as well as preventing the Eldar who live this lifestyle from focusing their thoughts for too long. We could speculate that this nomadic lifestyle is very deliberate as a means to prevent Exodite Eldar from becoming bored, spending too much time thinking about what else they might be doing, and start down a path that leads to despair once again. This is perhaps why they chose such a life of simple hardship. The devil makes work for idle hands, or something far more applicable for the Eldari anyway. Now, most Exodite worlds are home to large herds of so-called megadons, or other gigantic reptilian beasts, who the Exodites refer to collectively as dragons. Now, Exodites follow these herds of animals as they graze, carefully managing them for food, not only partaking of their flesh, but of their blood as drink, skins as clothing and leatherwork, bones and the horns, which act in part as a substitute for the psychoplastic substances known as wraithbone, used by Craftworld Eldari. Basically, they are as the indigenous people of North America once followed the buffalo herds. The massive herbivores known as megadons are essentially then the cattle of the Exodites. Although deadly if panicked and mistreated, they're generally quite peaceful and provide most of the material resources used by Exodites. Some smaller and some larger megadons may be used for transportation and cargo. The smaller, more carnivorous dragons are ridden by the Exodite warriors, and these are called Dragon Knights. They use these to herd and control the Megadons, and it goes without saying they're masters in the saddle, in either the role of defense or attack. Exodites, because of their separation and turn away from the reliance on the warp, do not use the material commonly the bedrock of Eldar society known as Wraithbone, for this is psychically grown, crafted, and used in Craftworld Eldari technology, armor, weapons, and even their vehicles. Wraithbone is essentially the primary building material of the Eldar, but here among the Exodites, it's exceedingly rare. While the Exodites will rely on resources and materials from their cattle and natural world, many still though do possess some elements of their advanced technologies and the knowledge of how to use them. Their lifestyle is one of choice, but they also choose to retain the capability to change from this should it be necessary, which seems honestly a wise choice. They turned their back on the culture of the Eldari way, not necessarily its knowledge specifically. But distance is no escape for an Eldar from the threat of chaos, specifically Slaanesh. Only those who exist in the Webway, like the Jakari, have some modicum of safety in this regard, and so it is essential that every Exodite homeworld still has its equivalent to a Craftworld's infinity circuit. Exodites refer to this as their world spirit. Similarly to that of a Craftworld, it is a vast storage system for their psychic spirits or souls of dead Exodites. And when placed into the world spirit, they become safe from the threat of Slaanesh. But in order for this to happen, Exodites must also make use of those same psychoactive crystalline technology that the Craftworld Eldar use. And so the Exodites also are seen to wear spirit stones so that when they die, they may join the world spirit's crystalline shrines and their souls join with the sea of spirits contained within. This world spirit is usually connected via shrines across the entire planet, and for those who retain the psychic ability to do so, they can interact with the spirits of the deceased, just as those upon Craftworld will do with their infinity circuit. These shrines are made from psychically interactive crystals and contain essentially massive spirit stones that anchor the world spirit's psychic power into the planet itself. The links between these stones form a part of the Eldari Webway, but the paths from the Webway into the different world spirits are well hidden and very obviously heavily guarded. While Exodites move around their worlds and have generally no specific permanent home to create a large settlement around, they're committed to remaining on Maiden Worlds, and if attacked, other Eldar may even come to ally with them in defense of the world spirits here. To abandon a planet or allow the world spirit to be compromised by others is essentially allowing Slaanesh to feast upon the souls of the departed, obviously something that no Eldar would ever wish to see happen. Such invasive incursions upon Exodite worlds can be supported even by the likes of the Eldar Phoenix Lords. And so when Chaos invaded Exodite worlds known to the Eldar as the Three Sisters, three of their most famous Phoenix Lords, Baharoth, Fugan, and Karandas, would aid the Beeltarn Craftworld in suppressing and destroying the demons. Farseers and Warlocks would cleanse the rest of their worlds from any Eldari enemies with powerful psychic tempests. Yet the displays of power and ferocity against the bitter enemies of the Eldari were not something witnessed nor imagined by young Exodites. And so it would be that many of the young warriors who were in awe of these Phoenix Lords saw their lives of isolation were perhaps not serving their race to the best of their abilities, and so felt the call to join with the Beeltarn Eldar, enraging for the Exodite leaders who felt this to be an outrageous betrayal, but perhaps a sign that along with Ivrain and the Inari, the Eldar were entering a time of change, and just as the Craftworld Eldar were known to aid the Exodites, now things were coming full circle. Now, after fairly two lengthy descriptions, we get to one that's far more straightforward. A Xenos world is quite simply the collective designation given to a planet by the Imperium's Adeptus Administratum when it lies outside the control of the Imperium of Mankind, and which also has been settled by an at least sentient and somewhat capable alien species. We might wish to say intelligent, but calling orcs intelligent might be something of a stretch. While there are, of course, visible Xenos spread throughout the galaxy that the Imperium has to deal with via regular warfare, the likes of the Orc, the Tyranid, the Eldar and so on, there are many other smaller alien races who may inhabit a singular world they consider to be their homeworld, or perhaps localized star systems close to such a homeworld. Were these planets needed by the Imperium for resources or as a tactical position within the galaxy, or should they just become problematic, then they may face the full power of the Imperium, otherwise they will generally be ignored. Of course, This somewhat contradicts the impression that the Imperium of Mankind is on a permanent genocidal alien hunt looking to scour the galaxy of any and all who are not themselves. The only ones that are doing that are the Tyranid. And when it comes to the majority of intelligent alien species, outside of those which are the most notable, they are in fact comparatively technologically primitive, unaggressive, or lack any true power in the galactic arena. It's worth remembering, for example, that on some hive planets of the Imperium, humans are not even aware of Xenos in the galaxy. They spend their entire lives completely contained within their planet and their hive world. Rumours of Xenos out in the galaxy are for them wild stories, and only the highest members of a nobility, governorship, and perhaps PDF will really have any sense of what is occurring off-world. It's true, of course, that strange stories from traders and the rare few who may return from having been off-world with all manner of story to tell, but these are akin to fishermen's tales, and by the time they've filtered down into the populace, they're little more than myths and rumours, not much more than children's stories to scare. Of course, the reality is far more troubling than most humans would want to or are even capable of comprehending in M41. So far better that they stick to their work and not think too much about the wider galaxy and the fact that there is likely a gargantuan Tyranid hive fleet heading straight toward them. Necron Tomb Worlds. Now, I hope you may appreciate that this could easily spiral into explaining the entirety of Necron history if you wanted it to. So I'll say right now, this is going to be kept relatively simple, lest this video become 3 hours long, because I feel like I'm already sounding like a Necron in this video. Now, we already know that many millions of years ago, the Necron, or Necron tier, if you like, they seem to be interchangeable for some reason, entered into their great sleep, having vanquished their enemies, the Old Ones and Catan alike. Their supreme leader, known as the Silent King, had deemed that for now the time of the Necrons was over. This was not least because of the emergent Eldari, powerful psykers created by the Old Ones to aid them throughout the war in Heaven, and had thus come to also hate the Necrons. The Eldari had survived where the Old Ones had not, and more importantly thrived, and were a force that seemed to grow ever more powerful with their immense psychic weaponry. The Necrons, who had been weakened during the overthrow of the Catan, were then unable to stand against them. The Silent King believed that the time of the Eldari would pass, as would the time of all flesh, so he would decree that the Necron would leave the galaxy, that is, to pass out of sight of the mortal races, to weather the war against entropy, not literally leave the galaxy. The mortal races would have to stand against the attrition of time alone. For the Necron, such matters were of no concern. They stood ready to outsit eternity. The Silent King would order all remaining Necron cities to be dismantled, transformed into these great underground tomb complexes threaded with stasis crypts. So the Necron were essentially ordered to fall into a sleep for a period no less than 60 million years, and awaken ready to rebuild all that had been lost, and for their dynasties to restore their former glory. Zarek, last of the Silent Kings, sailed into the blackness of intergalactic space, into the void between galaxies, there to find whatever measure of solace or penance he could. Meanwhile, eons passed, and the Necrons slept on. But this would not be the last time the Necrons would know Zarek. Unfortunately, because of the vast timescales involved, many tomb worlds are now settled planets of the Imperium of Man. The fact that they are tomb worlds is not something any are aware of until they are, and at that point things become obviously problematic. In terms of scale, Necron tomb worlds are very obviously significant installations. They can contain millions of Necron as well as the hardware to support their dynasty. This means vessels, transport, and massive machines of war. The tombs at a practical level contain extensive repair facilities prepared millions of years previous, which are manned by tomb spiders whose singular role is to continually repair Necrons. Also, any that were critically damaged in battles, and overall these will be vast caverns of Necron within stasis units seeming to go on for almost infinity, although very obviously not. And while more especially ornate rooms will contain the higher members of a dynasty, such as their lords and perhaps even Catan shards housed in vast obsidian sarcophagi. The Necron existed in their prime so long ago that almost nothing of their specific origin locations is known, and all that is known is that their number remains significant. And this means that likely a very concerning unknown number of tomb planets exist across the galaxy in the 41st millennium. Of these, some tomb worlds are likely the settled worlds of the ancient Necron tier species that eventually became the Necron. Imperial explorators have often found Necron tier ruins deep beneath the surfaces of worlds that appeared otherwise lifeless, dead, and uninteresting. This is a very common occurrence. Many Necron tomb worlds are dead worlds, with their surfaces often lifeless, barren deserts, perhaps even lacking any atmosphere. The time span of their slumber is immense, and so many worlds have lived and died since they entered their long period of sleep. Alternatively, some Imperial scholars believe that the Necrons scoured and cleansed all life from their own worlds millions of years before, so as to perhaps not make them appealing to other mortal races, but the truth is really unknown. The fact that any of these sites have been discovered can be beneficial still for the Imperium in preemptively preparing to deal with a situation. And this is largely thanks to the archaeological expeditions carried out by the Adeptus Mechanicus Explorator teams, who are of course looking to uncover ancient STC technologies or rogue trader expeditions hoping to turn a profit from whatever Xenos materials they discover. Unsurprisingly, many of these explorator teams disappear without a trace upon discovering Necron tier ruins that have commonly led them to inadvertently activate the tombs of the dormant Necron that lie beneath the sands. Their ships in orbit quickly are obliterated by ground-to-orbit defences deep below the surface. For the Necron, things have gone far from as was planned, though. The awakening of their people has been a scattered, uncoordinated, disjointed affair. The Necrons have not arisen as one mighty power to retake their rightful place in the galaxy, but instead through juddering and inconsistent bursts over many millennia. Despite the best efforts of their repair systems and drone units, the vast timescale of their sleep has led to significant errors in their circuitry and the protocols designed to ensure that a unified revivification would take place in the early years of the 41st millennium. This did not take place, and in fact the very first of the tomb worlds to revive did so almost 10,000 years early to witness mankind's great crusade. Tomb worlds are also considerably vulnerable during this revival process for the Necron within the tomb. This is primarily due to the immense quantities of energy required, and as such large energy signatures can attract unwanted attention. At this early stage, their defence lies with the canoptic spiders, scarabs, and wraiths, far from the most powerful tools of the Necron arsenal. They also are only guided by the tomb's master program, whose decision matrix will allow it to calculate an efficient response to any perceived threat, which then will scale accordingly. Once, though, a tomb's first legions have awoken, its master command protocols will pass to the Necron nobles of said tomb. And this is when other races of the galaxy, be it humanity or something else, have colonized a Necron tomb world heavily, the chances are they'll know nothing about it until seemingly out of nowhere they're hit with a massive and extremely aggressive attack. Its rulers having awakened to find their full power revived, their forces awaiting command. In many ways, the Necron dynasties who have found themselves in such a position have benefited from those Xenos threats, as it has enabled them to expand more rapidly comparative with those who have been more gently coaxed out of their slumber. It is a process, though, still that can take decades or even centuries, and it cannot be hurried. Sometimes recoveries will never occur, and the sleeper is doomed to exist in a permanent, forever mindless state. What remains significantly troubling for the Imperium is that even toward the end of the 41st millennium, it is believed that there are many thousands of tomb worlds scattered throughout the galaxy, billions of Necrons who still slumber in their tombs across countless unknown worlds, many likely beneath well-established civilizations. Tomb worlds, though, are also a very depressing state for the Necron Empire, who once, like their bitter rivals the Eldar, held mastery of technology far beyond the ability of humanity in M41, yet now all that remains of their civilization and culture are scattered, broken memories. When a tomb awakens, no matter how successful the revival process is, there will be many whose minds fled during hibernation and whose bodies have been co-opted by a tomb world's master program. In the time of the great biotransference undertaken by the Necrontyr to move from feeble mortal forms to eternal living metal, a secret that was not told to the ordinary peoples was that there were not the available resources to provide all Necrontyr with bodies capable of retaining full personality and awareness. This is why the vast majority of Necron are now lost, little more than shambling metal undead, incapable of individual thought and comprehension. They no longer experience emotions nor experience, yet disturbingly similar to Imperial servitors within each Necron warrior or the shambling lower classes, they are believed perhaps to still retain a minuscule spark of self-awareness. Nothing they can act upon, only a terribly sad echo of their former selves that it might torment them, with shadows of memories, confusion, and a feeling that things were once very different. If they ever came to the realization of the truth, it's sure that many ordinary Necron would surely welcome true death. But of course few, if any, will ever achieve the capacity to realize it, and even if they did, they would be unable to act on such a realization. For a time, it appeared that the Necron were doomed, in their staggered and broken reawakening, to be ineffectual in their plan to once again dominate the galaxy. Yet now, their Silent King has returned from his exile, and where once the Necron may have looked to turn upon one another as readily as their mortal enemies, now they appear poised to unite, and a unified Necrontyr is a greatly troubling thing. To make matters worse, they have been observed to be activating a vast network of obsidian pylons. These are made of blackstone, an ancient stone capable of either enhancing or nullifying the power of the warp and psychus. While the Imperium and some within Chaos have begun to realize the capabilities of such material, the Necron are the masters of blackstone. And as I've speculated before now, within the broken and scattered mythology of the Eldar and Necron, it's not entirely clear who created the gargantuan ancient blackstone fortresses, massive space vessels capable of destroying worlds. It is said to have been, according to the Eldar mythology, at the hands of their god, yet ancient gateways and complexes have been discovered containing both Eldari and Necron ruins, carved into the same structure. So I still believe there is a possibility that it were not just the Necron nor the Eldar who saw victory in the war in heaven, but that perhaps together they cooperatively saw that the power of the Catan and the warp were too dangerous and sought to destroy and seal them both. The war in heaven is spoken of in terms of almost tearing the galaxy apart, and it may well be that the Eldar and the Necron saw that they had been pitted against one another, and that if this war continued on to its endpoint, it would destroy everything. However, a lot of time has passed since then, and they still retain a lot of bitterness. While the Silent King has returned, there is much activity within the Necron, their tomb worlds continue to awaken, their power continues to grow. All the while, the Imperium continues to encounter their so-called Pariah Nexus, regions of space that present vast psychic null fields where ships cannot enter the warp or exit, psychers are rendered ineffective, and even ordinary mortal humans begin to suffer the effects of the Pariah. Just what will occur within time remains to be seen. Zarek the Silent King has long sought to restore his civilization and people, not just to a position of power, but to reverse what they lost in the process of biotransference. Both the Eldar and Necron seem to be making grand plays for a huge change in the galaxy. The worlds of the Xenos have become suddenly ever more concerning.